Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. This Friday, we are addressing your questions about COVID-19 and how the state is addressing the pandemic. During Governor Phil Scott's media briefing on Tuesday, we learned that COVID cases had increased by 26% in the past 7 days, even as Vermont continues to lead the country in vaccination rates. Scott also defended his decision to not reinstitute a state of emergency or a statewide mask mandate. His administration also discussed the new antigen testing program for schools and the booster shot rollout. Today, we have Vermont's Health Commissioner, Dr. Mark Levine, on the line to answer your questions. Dr. Levine, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Yes, and we apologize for the fire alarm that interrupted our conversation on Wednesday. That was quite eventful.
More so for you than myself, I think.
Well, everyone here is okay, and we're glad we could have you back on, because we sure do have a lot of questions, as we always do. Now, Dr. Levine, I asked you this question on Wednesday, and then we got cut off by that fire alarm, so I'm going to just pose it to you again right off the bat. We want to talk about monoclonal antibody treatments. This was something that you brought up at the press conference on Tuesday, and they've been shown to lead to better outcomes for high-risk COVID patients. How many monoclonal antibody treatments has Vermont gotten from the federal government, and how many have actually been administered here?
Sure. So from the beginning of this year to this point in time, somewhere in the 550 to 600 doses have been administered in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And the pace seems to be accelerating. We were doing probably 50 a month early on in this calendar year. And now we had a week last week where there were 40 just in 1 week.
Hmm. What's led to that increase?
Oh, I think the rate of cases that you commented on earlier is certainly a factor in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think greater recognition by the clinical community and possibly by Vermonters themselves that this modality of treatment is available, because it is an effective treatment. I do believe in it tremendously at this point. You may recall early in the pandemic, there was a fair amount of skepticism about it.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that had to do with data and science, more so than just intuitions. But the reality today is that there's excellent data and science to support its use with the Delta variant, actually, specifically, but with COVID in general. And what we know is that the earlier in the course that you get the therapy, the better that will be in terms of its likelihood of success. And we know that there can be as much as a 70% improvement in terms of rate of hospitalization or severe outcomes. So it's certainly a good modality to utilize.
Now, if somebody, one of our listeners, either has COVID or has a family member or friend who has it and they're interested in this monoclonal antibody treatment, is that something that you think most doctors in the state are prepared to administer, have access to, and have information on?
So it is a little complicated. So that's part of the reason for concern and why we're trying to publicize it a little more. First of all, it doesn't mean everyone who tests positive should get monoclonal antibody. It really is supposed to be reserved for those who are at the highest risk. And what does that mean? Well, certainly people over 65, certainly people with those kinds of medical conditions that we've talked about previously, like heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, obesity, smoking history, people who might have a worse prognosis by getting COVID. So that's really important to start with. The second thing is that a physician most likely is not going to administer it in the office and or just write a prescription for it, because it's given intravenously at infusion centers, which are generally every hospital in the state, minus two. So it's pretty geographically distributed. There's also an urgent care center that's giving it as well. The newest news has to do with the fact that if intravenous use is not convenient or challenging to accomplish, it can be given through a needle under the skin. So we are trying to actually explore doing that more commonly in places like long-term care facilities, where some of the population may be eligible for the treatment, but it might be a bigger deal to have to transport them to an infusion center. There might be some time that has to elapse for that, and it could be brought to the infusion to the long-term care facility and given through a needle in the skin. That would be much more convenient. So we're embarking down that pathway now as well.
Now, you mentioned that these monoclonal antibody treatments are growing in use in part because of the prevalence of the Delta variant. And I want to talk a bit more about that because, as I said earlier, here in Vermont, cases have increased 26% over the last 7 days. That was a statistic given on Tuesday. And back in early August, the word was that this was a temporary spike. It'd go down by September. September turned to October, and we are still dealing with this surge. And we've gotten a lot of questions as well, saying, folks are wondering if they need to start changing their behaviors again, stop going out to dinner, stop doing other things because of this continued prevalence of Delta here in Vermont. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. What's leading to this continued high case number rate?
It's very interesting, and no one has the exact answer. But if you look at the Northeast, we'll start a little bit beyond Vermont. We are a very heavily vaccinated region. And so the initial uptick in Delta occurred here, as it did in other parts of the country, though it was somewhat delayed compared to places like the South of the United States, where the vaccination rates were much lower. Their rise and their peak was much higher. Ours was much more of a gradual rise to a sort of plateau area where we find ourselves remaining. If you look within New England, the southern New England states seem to be improving at a faster rate than the northern New England states, because all three of us northern New England states are seeing the same phenomenon occurring that you just described for Vermont. Again, not a finger pointer by nature, but looking at the cases every day, 70 to 75% are in unvaccinated individuals. 5 to 10% out of state. So again, it's not being driven by leaf peepers or tourists. And it's not being driven by 0 to 11-year-olds who are not eligible for vaccination. They make up around 10% of all of those cases on a given day, give or take. So again, it's challenging. Because of the fact that the unvaccinated are certainly driving the caseload, and I consider that to be fully preventable. And we're blessed that we have such a small percentage in Vermont compared to other states. Currently, we're up to 89% of Vermonters who are eligible for vaccine, meaning 12 or older, getting at least one dose. And we're just on the threshold of 80% being fully vaccinated from the eligible 12 and older population. So Vermonters are doing, again, a phenomenal job of stepping to the plate. And to be fair to the unvaccinated, though I would like to see many of them move a little faster, the reality is, we have vaccinated over 40,000 people since we got to the original 80% point, and Governor Scott said we're now removing the restrictions because the population has gotten to the goal. So we're doing very well, though there are still others to fall into line with that. Some may never, but we know from our recent experience that on a daily basis, we continue to see Vermonters getting vaccinated for the first time. And so I wouldn't want anyone to give up hope on anyone or do any finger pointing because we're seeing so much progress there. But I think we could exit this a lot more quickly if that progress really accelerated even further.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about schools, Dr. Levine. On Tuesday, the Scott administration announced there were 158 new COVID cases in K-12 schools in the previous week. And I believe that was the second highest 1 week total this school year. Now, as I understand it, the vast majority of students, they're wearing masks in school, they're following the protocols. But it seems like there is some sort of disconnect. Why are there still so many cases if kids are indeed, you know, masking so effectively?
That's a wonderful question. And it gets back to your other question about why are we seeing so many cases? Mm-hmm. So when we talk about, you know, cases from day to day, there are obviously cases that are associated with outbreaks. But outbreaks are accounting for really 20% or less of the cases in Vermont right now. So these would be outbreaks, you know, in schools, in long-term care facilities, in people's workplaces, etc. They're not huge, nor are they from large gatherings like the kinds of crowds you see at major sporting events or at a show venue or something of that sort. So in public health, we say that most of the cases are coming from community transmission. What that means for the public to understand is basically people gathering with one another. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that casual journey to a convenience store, a gas station, a supermarket, and going in there, wearing a mask, getting out fairly quickly. It's a transactional kind of basis. That's probably not leading to most of our cases, if any. Many times it's probably not even going into a restaurant in a restaurant that is doing what it's doing and playing by the rules and trying to keep people as safe with each other as possible. But it is people gathering together with one another. When usually they're not masked, they're not distanced, they're with a bunch of people they're comfortable with for a specific purpose. So when you talk about cases coming into the schools, it's probably not in the majority of those cases, though there are some examples where this is different, from an outbreak in the school where the student was sitting in a classroom and infected all of their classmates. That's more the exception, not the rule. But it is probable that the student who was infected brought the case in to the school at a time when they weren't even feeling ill and they didn't know they were infectious, but they'd acquired it outside of school in a gathering kind of setting. So that's sort of how we refer to those cases. And the schools are doing the right things and they're very vigilant about doing the right things. And now we're trying to add to their armamentarium with testing protocols that will hopefully keep even larger numbers of students in classes, even classes where there have been students infected, in an in-person learning environment and not have to quarantine at home.
Let's go now to Anne in Underhill, who I believe has a question about schools. Anne, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Great talking with everybody. My concerns were that if and when the vaccine becomes available for our 5 through 12 age children, whether that would be facilitated in a really super easy manner by having the vaccines perhaps at the school setting so that it would reduce all the stressors on families about getting all the kids here, there, and everywhere, and especially with moms and dads that have to tag along younger toddlers into sites. And I already know that the school systems are feeling stressed about being able to handle just the testing portions of things because there's a lot of staffing problems. But I didn't know whether the state had considered that that would be an easier option.
Dr. Levine, is the state already planning on how it's going to vaccinate 5 to 11-year-olds?
Yes, a lot of planning has already gone into play. We had a very successful experience with school-based clinics with our adolescents who are obviously still eligible for vaccination if they haven't got it, but where we're getting very good rates of compliance with vaccination. And so we'll continue to build on that success with the 5 to 11-year-olds. There's also now abundant pediatric and family practice settings where parents can bring their children to get vaccinated by their own physician on a scheduled basis. So they'll be participating in that, but they'll also be participating in helping some of the school-based clinics really operate the way we'd like them to. So there'll be abundant opportunities for parents in terms of their choices of where they can bring their children to get vaccinated. But the thought of the caller is one that we've had all along and will be implementing again.
We got an email from Susan in Mount Holly, and she has a situation she's hoping that you can address, and I'm guessing it's one that other folks have had to deal with as well. She says that she has relatives who haven't yet been vaccinated, and part of their reasoning to her is that if both vaccinated and unvaccinated people can transmit COVID-19, then they are, in fact, only putting themselves at risk and not others by their decision, and they say that they're young and healthy enough to withstand infection. So how would you suggest that Susan responds to that situation?
Yeah, so there's a couple of points to be made. There is some evolving science now on how transmissible a person who has been vaccinated really is. One of the reasons the CDC changed their guidance in the first place, insisting that people who are indoors mask, whether they're vaccinated or unvaccinated, is because of the concern that even though your bloodstream is very protected, meaning your major organs like your lungs are protected by having received the vaccine, perhaps you could still get the virus to multiply within your nose and the mucous membranes of your nose, because the immune system wouldn't be that revved up immediately when you first came in contact with the virus. And so it could multiply there and spread to others. Now there's some question about that, but I'm calling it an evolving science because the final word is not yet in, and I don't want everyone to just take their masks off and go, it never was a problem anyways, because we're not there yet. But you know, like everything with the pandemic, we've been learning all along, and we will continue to learn. And we often learn in real time. And so we take the learning we do and we implement it in terms of changes in guidance and policy. But we're not ready for that yet. But so let's make the assumption that everyone can still transmit the virus if they get it in their nose to others. The part of the argument that your listener made that I'm not going to subscribe to is, well, we're young and healthy and it's not a big problem.
Right.
We can handle the virus, whether we're the 5-year-old child or whether we're the 30 to 40 year old parent or what have you. The reality is we are going to have another pandemic after this pandemic, and people are now calling it the pandemic of long COVID. Long COVID are people who have symptoms well after they should have resolved their illness. And in fact, that they often did resolve their illness acutely. But then you talk to them 3 or 4 months or even beyond that later, and they're having symptoms that are distressing. Some may be as severe as unrelenting fatigue and inability to get out of bed. Others may be milder. Others may have this phenomenon called brain fog, where they just don't think they're thinking well or have adequate memory or shortness of breath or what have you. And physicians are seeing more and more of these cases, but they're probably representing a small percentage of those who got ill. On the low side, people say 10%. On the high side, 30%. But it's all just being studied because now we're into the pandemic well over a year and a half, and we're seeing what's happened to the population. So I wouldn't want to wish any of that on anyone who just chose to sort of take the chance to get the infection, and that's how they'll become immune and they don't need the vaccine or anything, because I would much rather prevent the infection, not have any possibility of getting those long symptoms, and do better for it. So I would just encourage people who have thought about, well, reasons why I won't get vaccinated. Number one, I'm healthy and it's not going to hurt me. Well, That's not always true, though percentage-wise, the younger will do better than the older getting the infection. Number two, I won't have any long-term impact. Well, I just told you about long COVID. Or number three, hey, this monoclonal antibodies, I can get treated if I get sick. So why should I worry about getting sick? Well, the reality there again is that you're taking a lot of risk by getting ill, even if we have a treatment to try to help rescue you with. And then fourthly, the fact is we know that the combination of so-called natural immunity, meaning getting it through the infection, plus the vaccine related immunity you get from getting vaccinated is a superpower kind of thing. It really markedly provides you with protection for the future.
Let's go now to David in Duxbury. David, you are on the line. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Dr. Levine. My question is, roughly 90% of Vermonters have been vaccinated and are well protected. And out of the 10% that haven't been vaccinated, do you have an idea of how many have already been exposed to COVID, survived it, and have natural immunity?
Yeah, I wish I did. I don't have a complete picture of that. But again, I don't want them to rely on natural immunity for their future, because we know that they can augment that substantially and reduce any future risks. I will say that if we're getting close to 90%, I'd rather you use the 80% level for the fully vaccinated. And the reason for that is very good evidence in the scientific literature that one dose of a two-dose messenger RNA vaccine is totally inadequate to give you confidence that you won't get Delta. It only gives you a protectiveness rate of about 40%, which is much less than even half of what you could get with getting both doses. So it's really that fully vaccinated rate that's critical. And you know, along the way in this pandemic, at many of our press conferences, I was kept getting the question about what number do we need to get to call community immunity, herd immunity? Where do we have to get to? And I never wanted to answer the question, and I always gave a very broad range, which was generally in the 70 to 90% range. Nothing less than 70%, but certainly didn't want to make that the goal. And now we're finding, just through experience with the Delta pandemic from around the world and from here, that most people aren't comfortable with a number less than 90% for that community immunity level. And that's what explains why even highly vaccinated Northeastern U.S. Still had an impact with the Delta strain.
Let's go now to Aaron in Queechee, who's been waiting patiently on the line. Aaron, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Levine, my question, I actually recently contracted COVID. I was fully vaccinated with the Pfizer. And I know that obviously there's a chance of, anyone who has gotten vaccinated to still get COVID. It was a mild case at that. But I have no idea where I contracted it, and no one I interacted with developed COVID, including my 5-month-old daughter, who was vaccinated. I was vaccinated when I was pregnant with her. But my question was in terms of whether children can be carriers of COVID in terms of even perhaps having very low viral loads and not even testing positive on the PCR. She tested negative, when I was tested the first time and then 10 days later. Just kind of curious in terms of your thoughts on that.
Interesting question. Dr. Levine, can children and babies be carriers in that way?
Yeah, so, I mean, the true answer would be yes, but it wouldn't be an emphatic yes, because the reality is we have a lot of literature. Let's go back to the schools from earlier in time when we were advocating for more hybrid and in-person education, last year, that really showed us that there was not a lot of transmission going on from students to adults, or even from students to other students most of the time in those settings. So that probably means they're not having high viral loads. They're not having a high rate of transmission amongst one another. I wouldn't want to be very, lackadaisical about it, but at the same time, we do know now that Delta being so much more transmissible and contagious is affecting more of our five-year-olds and even younger and older. And so we have to still pay attention to that. I understand your sort of loss of like, where could I have gotten it from? I hear that story a lot. It's really challenging to really figure that out for many, many people. Unfortunate you did become one of those cases. The odds now of that happening, at least in Vermont, based on our data, is about 8 in 1,000 for previously vaccinated people. So not impossible, but not a very high risk either.
Let's go now to Bob in Londonderry. Bob, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm sort of wondering about the numbers, because when it comes to children, I have some children. The question is really looking for some numbers is how many children are there in the Vermont school system that are unvaccinated? So that's some probably a little bit of a guess. But and then how many of those have been tested positive for COVID Delta? That's the second number. The third number is how many of those have had symptoms, which I assume is much smaller. And I guess the ultimate question is how many of those with symptoms have had to actually been admitted to the hospital?
Dr. Levine, we have a math test for you. Friday math quiz. Go.
Yeah, and I don't have all of these numbers right at my fingertips. So we may have to get back to the listener with those numbers. But because there are, in the under 12 age group, there are several tens of thousands of students total. I'm thinking in the 40,000 range, but I don't want you to hold me to that number, and we can get the exact number. And I don't have a number right now to give you off the top of my head about how many have been infected. But we do know that they tend to be less symptomatic. That's for sure. And they quite uniformly in Vermont have very, very positive outcomes. The fact is we have had several hospitalized, and right now there's one in the hospital, several others who are in another hospital that, but they're not for a COVID-related reason being hospitalized. And the total number, I don't have at my fingertips either, but it's certainly going to be in the single digits or teens for total number of pediatric patients who have had to be in the hospital. And when they are in the hospital, they tend to be in the hospital for a very short time, very brief observational periods, what have you.
Wendy in Windsor is on the line and has a question. Wendy, go ahead.
Yeah, Dr. Levine, I had a comment to make. My son's partner is a ICU nurse doing COVID in San Diego right now. And I've been following a lot of what she's going through just as support. And she's there till January. She has seen, this is really towards the 30 and 40-year-old group who thinks that they're safe right now, not having the vaccine. And she's lost 2 40-year-olds and a 30-year-old, 30-something-year-old, in the last 2 weeks in ICU. One 40, early 40s had a 10-year-old son. So I don't think they're immune with their age for not being vaccinated to getting the virus. Thing that the anti-vaxxers and people who think that they're safe realize what's really going on in the ICUs.
Thank you for sharing that, Wendy. And Dr. Levine, are we seeing similar cases and fatalities amongst people in that age group here in Vermont?
We've not been spared that, but we're seeing that in very, very small numbers, very small. You know, Southern California right now is a success story. It's one of the very rare parts of our country that is not red on the map anymore. It's orange, which is making its way towards the more favorable colors of yellow and green when it comes to levels of transmission of virus and cases. So things are going well there. But obviously, one thing we always say is hospitalizations and deaths are lagging indicators. So even as cases diminish, the people who have gotten ill still have a chance to get more ill and have a more serious outcome. So that's really important to know. We have not had tremendous numbers of 40, 30 or younger deaths, age-old deaths in this state, but we have not been immune from that either. Many times they are in a compromised state, which would predispose them to that, but no one is invincible, as the caller points out. And we shouldn't just take COVID lightly, thinking that most people are going to do fine. I think if you're vaccinated, you should have more confidence than if you're not vaccinated. But if you're not vaccinated, you shouldn't risk what the illness could potentially do to you, or so-called play the odds and think that you'll do fine, especially knowing the safety of the vaccine. If there were any concerns about these vaccines that were substantial, I would understand why someone would choose not to get vaccinated. But now we have well over a year of safety data, and that's really important to take into account when you figure out for your own personal decision-making what you would do or not do with regard to vaccination.
Now, we were speaking earlier about community transmission, and we got an email from Chris in Montpelier who asked, is it safe to have state employees go back to state offices on November 1st as COVID-19 cases are now on the rise? So I'm curious, Dr. Levine, what you think of that return to offices for state employees when, as you say, community transmission is something that we should really be keeping an eye on.
Right. So again, part of that has to do with how safe is the workforce. So one thing that's been put into play to make it safe is, of course, vaccination. And a mandate for vaccines is appropriate. And that is proving to be very successful. But in Vermont, we also have a pathway that one can take if they choose not to get vaccinated to be tested on a regular basis. So the combination of having a vaccinated workforce and a regularly tested unvaccinated workforce automatically makes the state office work site a very different work site than a run-of-the-mill work site that doesn't have anything mandated for its workforce at all. So I want the caller to keep that in mind. Obviously, I'm not making the decisions for the whole state about coming back to work or not, but the whole team of us will be looking at all of the data as those dates become closer in time for when people are supposed to come back to the work site. And obviously, if there's a need to reevaluate, that would occur. But I think right now, we've maximized the opportunity for the work site to be as safe as it could possibly be made. And you need to keep that front and center.
Well, let's keep our Montpelier streak going. We have Todd on the line from Montpelier. Todd, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Okay, great. I wanted to make a comment, and perhaps Dr. Levine can address it afterwards. And I want to thank you, Dr. Levine, for all these press conferences and all these times on VPR and everything and being so available. But my comment had to do with the reasons for younger people who are vaccine hesitant or skeptical to take the vaccine. And every single thing that you mentioned had to do with the personal gain to them in taking the vaccine. And I think for me, at least 50% of this is our collective responsibility to protect our communities and our state and our country and the world. And that a big part of taking the vaccine is to suppress transmission in the community And another part is to reduce the number of hosts that are available for the vaccine to mutate into something that could be worse. So I'd like to see you address that a little bit, I guess. Thank you.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. You said a lot of the things I enjoy saying from time to time. So you've done a great job there. What I'll add is that, again, there's some terminology that we can put on the table. Vaccine resistance, vaccine hesitancy, vaccine apathy. We have some data, it's survey data, but that's important, that tells us that the level of vaccine resistance, meaning someone is so skeptical that there's no way they're ever going to get the vaccine, is very low in Vermont. It's not the reason for the majority of the people who fall in that 60,000 person unvaccinated realm. It's much more likely that they're in one of the other two groups. So let's address the vaccine hesitant group. Most of their reasons are, number one, I just haven't found the time, or it's just not a big priority for making the time. I'll get around to it when I get around to it. Or that they are waiting, sort of the sitting on the fence kind of mentality, where I'm kind of ready for it, but you know, I just want to make sure all those other people don't grow an extra limb or something because they got the vaccine. So I'm going to wait and see. So my answer to both of those is, number one, 1.5 years, you know, of vaccines that have been in trials or have been in the population, and we're not seeing long-term effects. And number two, our state posture, which comes directly from the governor, is we are being relentless with offering vaccine. We are still one of those rare states that's having clinics everywhere around the state, and you can find a convenient place to go when and if you decide to get vaccinated, whether it's a state-run clinic, whether it's at a major venue like a raceway or what have you, or whether it's actually a pharmacy that's accepting walk-in vaccine patients, or your own doctor's office. It's really going to be hard-pressed for you to not stumble across the vaccine. And then the last group is really the vaccine apathy group, which may actually be larger than we think. And when I say vaccine apathy, it just means nothing really against the vaccine, just haven't really got around to it, and it's not a priority for me right now. In fact, I don't even think about it much. I'm just living my life, and it's fine. I don't, you know, what's the vaccine going to add? And so for them, it's really just a matter of loved ones and trusted individuals making sure that they know that they care about them. And by the way, we'll help you get vaccinated if you don't know how to do that. And we'd like to suggest you do that again, because I do subscribe to the caller's real major point, which is altruism, trying to protect each other. And with COVID, the biggest protection, of course, is for the most vulnerable people in our society, who may be older, but may be younger and have significant conditions that make them higher risk. Vaccination is one of the ways we help protect the population at large.
I believe we have time for one more caller. Let's go now to Jonah in Wells River. Jonah, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to bring up the recent uptick in cases in Vermont as compared with the other states in the Northeast. We're actually up. We were going up. Maybe it's changed in the last day or two, but the trend was that we were going up when we thought we would go down. And we're also the most vaccinated state, at least in the region, if not in the country. And also the fact that, which was one of the most vaccinated countries and certainly one of the earliest, and such a high prevalence of COVID in the vaccinated. I wonder, are we a little too sure of the vaccine, or is it definitely as good as we thought?
All right, Jonah, I'm going to cut you off there and let Dr. Levine answer, because we only have about 30 seconds left. Dr. Levine, are we too sure of the vaccine?
No, I think we're not too sure of the vaccine, because we don't need Vermont data. We need all of the clinical trial data and all of the experience since the vaccines have been out, whether it be international, national, or regional. And we have great reason to be confident in the vaccine. We also have great reason to be confident that we're identifying all our cases, because we're the third highest testing state. And being the third highest testing state, we are picking up cases that maybe aren't showing up in other states because people aren't getting tested as widely. And we have great access to our testing sites now. We've really worked on them. So please retain faith in the vaccine. Don't be demoralized by the numbers. We will transition to where we hope to get to, which is a steadily decreasing number of cases.
Well, I think that note of hope is a great place to end our conversation for the week. Dr. Mark Levine is Vermont's health commissioner. Dr. Levine, thank you as always for joining Vermont Edition.
My pleasure. Thank you.